Summertime, that we're not really doing the best we can as individuals to create an attitude where these people can take it back home and say, you must go to Fairbanks, you must see this town. Any comments regarding this?
Now, I'm going to answer that rather ambiguously, I think, Chuck, and that is simply this. Some people, well, let me go back to an old story about the two caravans meeting on the desert and going in opposite directions. I think you may be familiar with this, Chuck. At any rate, there were two caravans traveling in opposite directions, but in the desert. And the leaders of the two caravans stopped and passed the time of day, as we'd expect, way out in the middle of nowhere. And one of them said, what kind of a city is such and such a place where we're headed? And the fellow that had been there and going the other way said, well, it's a very, very, very poor place. He said, I don't like it at all. It's no place to live. The people are hard to get along with. All they're interested in is making money out of me. And he says, I just got up and left there. And so the other fellow said, well, that's a funny attitude. And this fellow that ran down the city he just left said, well, what kind of a city am I going to now? In other words, that you've just left. And he said, I think you'll find it just about the same kind of a city that you left. The point being, of course, that a lot of people mm-hmm. go into a new place. Their attitude is that they don't have any interest in the place, that they're not going to get along regardless of where they are. They don't like any place. They simply can't. They're just not built that way. There are a lot of military families here, Chuck, that are wonderful people. I've met a good many of them. I see a good many of their wives over here in St. Joseph's Hospital who are having babies. And I talk to them. A lot of them are people that plan to stay here. Some of them are wives of military men who have been recently discharged and decided to make their home here. They're fine people. They would get along anywhere. If they happen to wind up in the middle of South Africa in some grass hut village, they'd make the best of the situation, make something out of it, and make a life for themselves. So that to me would be the answer to your question, mm-hmm. really. As far as what Fairbanks does for the military or vice versa, there's a mutual sort of thing. We live very close together. And I don't think it's all bad on either side. There are some bad points. Some of the military complain that they think they're being taken when they get downtown to shop. Some of the merchants think that while they're shopping out on the base at their post exchanges and they don't come into town, we really don't have anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. They don't have anything to do with us. So it's a little bit of each way. There's something to be said on both sides. Now, well, that is a little of the fence I'll put in with you.
Right. What about, though, the actual tourist market, the people that are coming up here for their three-week vacation, their two-week vacation, the retired couple that buys a camper and drives up the highway, these people, again, speaking not as the community effort, but as the individual effort, the hellos, you know, we're glad to see you here. The post office is over there. If you want to see something interesting, go out and see the dredges. So this I don't mean to be silly at all, because it's that, we might call it almost the human attitude or the contact of the individual to the individual that promotes this industry. And maybe we better back up even further and say, what about the industry itself? Do you think it's something we should develop?
Oh, definitely, very definitely. As far as the attitude on people that come in here for 2 to 3 weeks vacations, or 2-3 week vacations, that's a little rough, Chuck, because you take someone who doesn't have too much money, is on a limited income, or if he's retired on a limited retirement, comes in here for a couple of weeks, it's expensive for him. There's no doubt about it. It is expensive. It's the distance involved, for one thing, and the transportation costs, even if you're driving over the highway, it is expensive. And we don't have too much here developed to take care of them yet. I think we will have as time goes on, and I think it's important that we do have. But the people that I think right now, until such time as transportation is a little less expensive, are going to be the people that have a little money to spend and want to see something and want to do something. Now, I have this friend of mine that made a trip with me down the Porcupine River this summer. He's an attorney back in Indiana, and I grew up together as kids. And Frank is not wealthy, but he's not poor either. He's got enough money so that he can do pretty much what he wants to do within reason. And for many years, he's been driving 1,800 miles from the middle of Indiana up into Manitoba, a place called the Paw. Two or three of them have a little hunting lodge up there to go moose hunting in the fall. Well, an 1,800-mile drive, the roads up there aren't very good. It's a long drive, any way you look at it. So he discovered Alaska here a couple of 3 years ago. He and another fellow flew in with a plane. And he finds it much more convenient, less expensive to come to Alaska than it is to drive that 1,800 miles up into Manitoba. And he finds more here when he gets here. And when he has left the two occasions he's been here, he's been very pleased with the trip, has enjoyed the country very much. In fact, he'll be back again next summer, and I expect we'll probably go down another river. But this type of person is, I think, probably the biggest potential we have in the immediate future. Now, maybe when you can press a button in New York and wind up in Fairbanks 10 minutes later, some future date, which I don't think is without the possibility.
It deserves a sneer. I think it deserves a careful ear.
Deserves an ear. When that happens and the cost isn't too high, then you will tap the market where the person has $200, $500, maybe $1,000 to spend on a vacation in only a couple of 3 weeks. But right now, that's a little rough. It's a little difficult. The distance involved is just too great, plus the expense. Now, if you had a two-week vacation and started to drive over that highway, if you figured a minimum of 5 or 6 days driving either way, there's 10 to 12 days out of 2 weeks shot. 2 days you've got where you wound up at your destination in this end. So that doesn't make too much sense.
This has happened, Morad, and it has happened even last summer, and it'll probably happen again. People coming to Alaska for short vacations that drive up, and they spend their entire vacation on a highway, and they go back home, and they said, "We were in Alaska. You should see the place. It's one great dusty road."
Yeah, right.
And it's
right.
Too bad that the opinion received by these people is in this way. Again, in promoting and in pushing, and I will use the word pushing, on an individual basis, this thing of the tourist industry, the tourist market, I think the responsibility of each person to realize not only the potential, but also the activity right then in each visitor we have is important.
Very important. Very important.
Anything we can do. There's so much to see in Fairbanks compared to any other populated area in the state. So
George,
much to do and see.
If we're going to talk a little bit later, maybe we can do this again. There is something here in Alaska that we haven't even really touched. And that is the midnight sun. Now, that is probably our greatest tourist potential as far as the large volume tourist is concerned. And I've got a couple ideas if you want to sit down and talk about them here for a minute. I will after a while. I think you probably want to take
a break here
in a minute.
I'd like to. Yes, it's getting close to a break. While we are still on the, we'll talk about it in just a moment or so about not only individual but groups ideas to develop our own tourist market. Our guest, Maury Smith, Alaskan, who needs no introduction. And, of course, our new state representative, news commentator, analyst, newspaper writer, and someone concerned in where we are and where we're going. We'll be back after a touch of music and full coverage report with more of what you want to hear. The music sounds pretty good like this.
That's nice. I'll put it next to a silver hoop I have that plays Sweet Leilani in March Talk.
That was a pretty good one. Herb, we almost missed that.
Oh, that's a shame, Chuck.
It sounded pretty good, though, whatever it was.
Oh, it was.
Right. Do we have any more music at all about a minute before 8 o'clock?
Oh, I think so.
...of Alaska and where it's going and all. There seems that you have definite and strong feelings about the Alaska that has been and what it has done to shape us to where we are now and the fact that you just don't throw this away. I mean, this is the foundation of where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a great deal to do with what we'll be developing. But I mention it to bring to point this. In the past few weeks, in fact about 3 weeks ago, we had a guest on the show who pointed out that this country needs some definite leadership, referring now to other shows, that in the past there had been some leadership, that this rugged individualism wasn't just where everybody went out and dug in everybody else's backyard. It was not so much that there was a person in mind, though, there was an idea in mind. And this is what provided some of this leadership. Now, a lot of this is just, you know, that's like talking about religion for 3 or 4 hours. But at the same time, it was brought out that Fairbanks needs some strong leadership, a person, not so much as a group, that will take so much of this that seems to be going one way or another in the form of anything from a chamber of commerce to a city government to city management to whatever it might be. Now, with all this, again, this dilemma, this horns are far apart,
What are your opinions on this? Do you think that Fairbanks needs strong leadership right now, as Anchorage had in its maybe city management in the past?
Chuck, it needs strong leadership, Chuck, yes. But there, I think you go to the people who make up your community for your leadership. Each individual, not so much one person or a committee or a group or Chamber of Commerce or City Council. They have their part, yes. But it still is the people that make up your community. The people that make up your community make your town. And their desire to live here, desire to make a home here, are the important things. Possibly informational direction they need, yes. That I would say definitely. But as far as someone getting up and waving a sword in the air and saying, we're going down this way, is concerned, that's a little ridiculous. I'm committed. I don't have much faith in groups doing things anyway, Chuck. Maybe I'm a little queer, but this reminds me of a definition of a camel. Chuck, I don't know whether you've heard this definition or
no,
not.
No, I haven't.
A camel with his two humps and rather idiotic construction. A camel is an animal that was put together by a committee. And
it, very good.
This committees have a tendency to go in all kinds of directions, and strong leadership in a committee, of course, usually means that it goes back down to one person doing all the work and having all the ideas. That's probably far enough to develop this particular line of thought. But still, a community is made up by people. Now, this gets into a lot of factors, too. For instance, federal aid. You hear such things on the part of your business leaders and your labor leaders and other leaders in your community. If we don't take this $100,000 or this $500,000, somebody else is going to get it. Well, to me, a community is not a community unless the people themselves build a community, make the community. That's one of the reasons why I was opposed in principle to urban renewal, and I still am. I think this urban renewal is something that takes the initiative out of the people's hands. It takes something away, a spark away from the community, the ability of people to do it for themselves. Granted that it might be tougher if you had to do it yourself. Granted you might have to give up a little extra income, possibly have to scale your scale of living down a little bit. But still, if the community does it itself, if the people of the community do it, this is good. This makes a community. I don't care where it is, whether it's Fairbanks or Hoboken or any place else. This is true, I think, universally.
Maury, there's been a great deal of emphasis, especially in the past 3 years, placed on the University of Alaska. It's tremendous growth, and its part is the community. It's been here since 1922. That's about it.
Right.
And by the way, you've been here how many years, you say?
25.
The University of Alaska here was here then before before you, of course, arrived.
Quite a while
before, of course. Any comments about the university? We'll preface it with only these ideas: the construction that's going on now, the passage of the recent bonding proposition, which will, according to what was said, now bring federal money in to build an Arctic research center and employ some 1,500 people. With this in mind and the tremendous growth at the university, what part in our community is it playing, or will it play?
It's going to play a tremendous part in our community, Chuck. I don't think there's any doubt about it. You've got cigarettes too. Thanks, Chuck. My pipe is gone out or something. Thank you. It's going to play a tremendous part, Chuck. There's no doubt about it. Anyone who says that it isn't just simply doesn't know. This research center, so many things have been developed in the way of creature comforts through scientific investigation that I think that we can see the day, even maybe myself as at my age, can see the day when living in the Arctic is going to be relatively simple due to the development of aids in living, heating things, construction and so on. There have been some rather fantastic, or what would seem to be rather fantastic, projections as to cities on the coast of the Arctic on ice and ice caps and so on. These are not fantastic, really. I think we'll see them someday. If man survives the bomb, we will. I'm quite sure. The university out here is going to play an important role, not only in the research, Chuck, but in the people that attend the university. The faculty itself, who have made their homes here, are going to play an important role. Now, the students themselves are going to take their places in our life here and be much better equipped for having gone to the university than they would be if they hadn't. There's just no argument there at all.
a well-trained, well-educated person has got a chance to really contribute something to our country. And the university out here is filling that need. And, of course, they're not perfect. They've got some things out there that have got to be changed. But in the whole, it definitely will provide a lot of the things we need in people.
Now, very good.
You know, Chuck, this is something that is not confined to Fairbanks and college out here either. I grew up on a university campus. My father was a college professor, still is, emeritus. But you have something here that I dislike seeing very much, and I grew up with this. A small town with a university. The university being a rather large part of the economy of the town, and the University of Alaska is. You have a resentment on the part of the people at the university toward the attitude of the people in town. You have a resentment on the part of the people in town toward some of the people at the university. This is silly, completely silly, really. There's a reason for it, but it unfortunately exists. Some of the people at the university have a tendency to stay out on their hill and ignore the town. They don't pay much attention to it. They don't want to have anything to do with it. They think they're being taken. They think it really doesn't have a part. Well, this is wrong, too. At the same time, there are a number of people in town, and I even know business people the same way, laboring people, and everyone, who resent someone that thinks he's a little better than they are. And that's partly what it boils down to. And this again, is ridiculous and silly. As I say, this exists practically, I suppose, in every small town where there is a university. You have a split. I know I went through that as a child. And I think the university and the town itself can give a little bit either way and join in and have a one-family rather than two-family arrangement. And both are important, the town and the university, both very definitely important.
And I think providing a lot of what we're, as you said, looking for in people, the economy, and everything.
You know, I'm talking about myself here quite a little bit, but I go back, I remember as a child, I couldn't have been more than about 12 years old. I was standing in a clothing store in this little town I grew up in, which had a university, somewhat similar situation to here.
Do you mind if we asked what it is and where it is?
Yeah, no, that's all right. It's DePaul University in Indiana, Greencastle, uh-huh. Indiana, a little town of about 12,000 people. But anyway, I was standing in a store there, barefoot, as a kid, running around downtown, and I heard a couple of the clerks and the owner of the store talking. They were talking about my father, who was on the faculty at DePaul there, and one of the fellows said, you know, O.H. Smith, talking about my dad, he's an awfully nice sort of a guy, nice fellow, but you know, he says he doesn't do anything very practical. Well, O.H. Smith was a physicist, or is a physicist, and he has developed a number of the graduate students that went into a lot of the research work that has developed everything up to the hydrogen bomb. Of course, you can argue whether we should have developed the hydrogen bomb or not, but we'll go into that. At any rate, I just wonder if those fellows talking now would say that there wasn't anything very practical about what Dad was doing at that time. It was intensely practical.
Well,
very practical, and it manifested itself in a lot of the developments we have now.
I think it well emphasizes the old premise, if you don't know, keep your trap shut.
And go find out.
Yeah, go find out. Or
stand there in ignorance. Go find out if you can. That's terrible when a person says, well, I don't know, and then just lets it go at that.
Right. Our guest, Maury Smith, Alaskan. Our time, 27 past 8. Santa Claus is coming to town. Do you have a chance to read very much?
That probably is the one thing I do and make a point of doing. Reading is something, and that brings up something else too, Chuck. One of the things you're talking about, people coming into this country not liking it, I found that over a period of years, and this is true anywhere, that people who are not capable of entertaining themselves or of doing a lot of their own thinking find a place like this sometimes hard to live in. If you have to have television, the neighborhood theater, or bingo or something to entertain you, this really isn't too good, although we do have those facilities here. Reading, I don't know how a person can get by in his own mind without reading. There's so many things to read, so many things of interest that bear on other parts of the world, other peoples that are of vital importance to us. I don't know how many magazines I've subscribed to, but it must run about 15 or 20. And these are magazines, many of them that you don't buy on the newsstand. They their ideas, thoughts, and information on all kinds of things. And I find it intensely interesting, and I wish more people would.
Can we ask some specifics? What do you read most?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the magazines, Chuck, that I like the best is Saturday Review. It's the old Saturday Review of Literature. They've dropped the word literature from the format, but the Saturday Review gives me a fairly good all-around insight as to what the thinking, current thinking is in the books that are being written and the feature stuff that they have on everything from education to science to the works. And that I faithfully read from cover to cover every week. I never miss that. It's tremendous. Of course, you take the usual Root, Harper's, and Atlantic, and some of those. I take a magazine called Current. I don't know if you're familiar with that one or not. It's the current thinking on current topics. Much of it I don't care for. But
you mean it's one of those magazines that really is its title?
Right.
I wonder whether it's Saturday Evening Post, you know.
It's a non-profit type thing. There's no advertising in it. Those magazines...
Heavens forbid.
Well, it developed out of another magazine that unfortunately couldn't make it because they didn't have the funds, and somebody came along and injected a little financial support. But these magazines, a lot of them, as I say, don't have anything in it that I'm particularly interested in. A lot of them do have. But I think people, even people who have not, say, been beyond high school, should get interested in that type of reading. I don't know how they could take a place in a society and be a part of it and a contributing factor to society without being somewhat informed, at least on the things that concern them and concern the people around them. Reading the popular magazines, there's something. Chuck, I know that you have the same feeling for that I do. You walk down a newsstand and pick up such, I can't even think of the names of the magazines at the moment, but titles that are leading you into. There's one magazine I've watched now for 2 years. Every cover has had a sex article in it, designed entirely primarily to make people buy the darn thing. It doesn't say anything. I've read a couple of three of them. And that ended it. They actually pass on absolutely no information whatsoever. Perfectly useless. Things that concern family living and so on. I don't know how many articles have been written about how to get along with your husband or vice versa, none of which really are very intelligent. This type of reading is for the birds.
Maury, this is a treat because there's been many comments made. What is television doing to your ability to read? And it's nice to hear someone who's on television quite regularly say that reading.
So have you got another job over here at KFRB?
No,
I'm just out of one.
No, I think that the two of them are most important. Both play an important part. Radio, television, and reading, they all play a part.
Television is primarily a huckster's medium. There's no other way to get around it. So is radio, as far as that's concerned, Chuck, if you want to go that route. As I say, I may be looking for another job here. I don't
know. Well, we may look together. I don't know. Maury, speaking of reading, then, and your other interests, and I know your love for the outdoors, any other particular hobbies that you have? And we know that you like to chop wood.
Yeah, well, yes, I do, really. It's enjoyable. Matter of fact, when I leave here, Chuck, I'm going to go up to a cabin I have on top of Esther Dome here, and I've got a little wood-cutting project to go for today. But I can cut a little wood, drop a tree, and buck it up with a sweet saw, and look out over the countryside. Nobody's going to bother me. I can do a little thinking, and it's quiet, and
wonderful.
I enjoy it, thoroughly enjoy it. It's a beautiful country, too, if you get out into it, incidentally. Incidentally, there's something else. People call this a wilderness. They call this country cold in the wintertime. But all they'd have to do would be to stand up on a hill and look at the late afternoon sun, or early afternoon this time of year, with a rose glow under the spruce trees, and I think that would settle the argument right there. Beautiful.
I think that we'll leave the question of hobbies there, because just being a part of the country is consuming. Both ways, vice versa.
Right, Chuck.
You mentioned the sun, and it all of a sudden reminded me that you mentioned sometime back, if we have a chance, let's talk about the midnight sun.
Oh, yeah.
So let's mention that if we can for a moment.
Chuck, I would. This is an idea. I'm not the person to do this because I'm not much of a promoter, but the midnight sun is one thing we have here that you don't have, for instance, in Iowa. You don't have it in Kentucky. You don't have it in Southern California. You don't have it in Washington State. But we do have it here in interior Alaska. And it's an unusual thing, and people enjoy it. It's something that they don't see until they come to a place like this. Now, one of the things ties in with this, Chuck, we hear when someone proposes, for instance, a park inside of Fairbanks, immediately someone gets up and says, well, we've got to have tax revenue property. All right, fine, that's great. We do need tax revenue property, there's no doubt about it. But at the same time, we do need some place where a housewife can wheel a baby buggy or walk down a little park in a town with a child. And what I'm getting at is this, I'm coming around a long way around. A midnight sun is attractive to people who don't have a midnight sun. We have it. What would be wrong, for instance, now this is just a hypothetical idea, what would be wrong, for instance, in taking one block that's vacant now down in that urban renewal, making a park out of it with the old type bandstand right in the middle of it. Now, going to universities, colleges, schools throughout the United States, and lining up various musical groups, all the way from modern jazz to symphony, choral groups, the whole bit, all the way through. Having those people come into this country for a Midnight Sun Festival, say, starting roughly around the 10th of June, lasting maybe till the 1st of July, 2-3 weeks. These groups, I'm sure some of them, would come here just simply for the fun of coming here. They had no really expense to Fairbanks at all, except maybe the upkeep of the park and a little help in housing. This could go for 2-3 weeks, and these people would come from pretty much all over the country. Now, they have these festival centers in New England and in some of the northern states, and they're tremendous out there. Of course, they have the short distances and so on, but here we do have something they don't have, and that's a midnight sun. And last year, Chuck, if you remember, this has been done before, but if you remember during the Golden Days, I believe it was, we had a group out on 2nd Avenue there that had guitars and all they had.
Boys from England.
No, this was a local group.
Oh, it was.
They had a dance right off on 2nd Avenue, right downtown, right in the middle of the afternoon. Well, I don't particularly care for that type of music. It doesn't interest me. But what did interest me was that it got a group of Fairbanksons out there that had a lot of fun for about 2-3 hours in the afternoon. It was great, real great. They liked that type of music, and they were enthusiastic about it. And I walked around through the area there in my usual rounds and watched the people, and it was tremendous. I felt good myself, even though the music didn't mean anything to me. But those things, I think, could be developed here. And I'm sure that these university groups, college groups, maybe even high school groups that have specialties in music would come here and schedule these things for various times of the day appropriately, maybe your early evening hours in that park for choral music, symphony music, classical, and so on, and then maybe the later hours for your modern jazz, get the youngsters out to dance in those areas, maybe have part of it paved, a hardtop in there where they can do that. Just an informal, spontaneous sort of a proposition. The cost of it, I don't think, would amount to much. For Fairbanks itself, I think it would be borne by a lot of the groups that underwrite such trips, and I know they are. They do exist from my own university.
Well, Maury, the music festival in Anchorage...
is great, yes. Very,
with
very
Robert
good.
Shaw and Julius Herford. Well,
what I'm talking about, though, Chuck, really are not name groups. I'm talking about, for instance, we had at DePaul a year ago a student choral group that sang everything from modern music to classical. And it was their own group. They took leadership from the music school at the university, but it was their own student group. Well, they toured Europe last summer. It didn't cost any one of them a cent. It was paid for partly by the university and partly by, and this is a private university, it's definitely not a state university, but it was paid for by two or three of the pharmaceutical houses, I believe, chipped in some money to get the kids over there, and they had a tremendous summer. I talked to two or three of them by letter here when they got back this spring or this fall. But this sort of thing could be done here, I'm sure.
It could be.
And it would bring a lot of people here.
Boy, I'm going to, along with thanking you so much for presenting this idea, which there are people. You know, this is, somebody says, well, somebody said something about it, now what? But there are people in this community, and we're not going to give names right now. Maybe one we think of, but there's so many, and we only can think of a few names at this moment, that are involved with groups and organizations that do things, and sort of highlighting what you said before. Let's form a committee, and if there's someone strong, they usually do all the work. But there are people that do things here, and they get things done. I hope if some group is listening to this idea, hope they'll give you a call, and we'll see what could possibly happen. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is the start of something.
I've done a little exploratory work on this by contacting head of the music department there back in Indiana, and they're interested in it, quite interested in it. And
this
could be done.
This sort of I just like to throw this in. I just mentioned it last week, and I'd like to mention it a few more times. If there is any, and believe me, any group right now that has an activity that is of community-wide interest, like the Fairbanks Winter Carnival or such as this, or Golden Days and all, we have the greatest opportunity in the world to advertise this to people all over the country, because we write more letters, send out more packages than any other people you can possibly imagine, as the post office tells us. We call more on the telephone. But speaking primarily of the mail, and speaking of winter activities and winter promotion, if some of these groups would get together, and if they had the money to print up something as simple as little stickers that say nothing more than "Come to Fairbanks Winter Carnival for the North American Dog Sled Races," or whatever it might be, and we could find a way to get these out to these people to slap on the back of these Christmas cards, I think we'd have one of the most fantastic advertising campaigns. A very inexpensive one, too.
Chuck, talking about advertising, one of the best advertising that we can have here in Fairbanks is the person who has come here, enjoyed his stay, and goes back and tells about it. That is the number one advertising.
Again, the individual responsibility that you and I and the folks listening right now have to be as aware of the visitor when he is here. Well, we must take a look at our weather, and we'll be back in just a moment as we meet the people, our guest, Maury Smith, Alaskan. Will probably be the most important steps that we'll take as far as Fairbanks in the next few years to come.
Oh, that is a large order, Chuck. That's a hard one to answer. One of the things that most people are concerned with here, myself, you, Paul Garwood sitting over there, and anyone who lives here, and that is that we don't price ourselves off the home market. In Juneau, I don't know yet exactly what can be done, but I do know this, that any more expense that's placed on the family that lives in Alaska can't be considered. It just is out. Because right now, the cost of living here cannot go up any more than it is. Taxes on top of other expenses sometimes make it almost prohibitive. This cannot go on. It's got to stop. If we have to cut down a little bit on some of the services, then I think we should cut down on them and maybe do some of the things ourselves. But just like some of the things I'd like to do and like to have done, I can't afford them, so I either do them myself or I don't. Now, we do have some things that we've got to spend money for in order to give ourselves a break in the future. The exploration for minerals, we talked about a while ago, is one of them. Some of the things are being done by our university out here. Some of the facilities, possibly, recreation-wise, we're going to have to spend a little money for those, too. But as far as adding to some of the services we already have, building up bureaucratic departments are concerned, it just isn't in the cards. You know as well as I know, and I'm sure that everyone here knows, that if you add another $200 or $300 onto the cost of living, or $100 onto our cost, either tax-wise or any other way, that it's just going to make it that much more difficult and much less desirable for people to make their homes here. Now, this gets down to an economic thing, and you don't like to have to place everything on an economic basis or on a cash register, but it has its place.
It certainly does, very much so.
There again, too, it's a matter of having a place to live in, a people that you like, and a country that you like. Do you want to make your home here? And this is becoming increasingly important as we have more families in Alaska, more families here in Fairbanks that are making their homes here. Not so many single men. There's nothing wrong with single men, of course, but not so many. Doesn't make up the largest portion of our population anymore. There are family people with children, and they're going to want opportunities for their children. They want a chance for themselves right now. I mean, this talk of the future, sure, it's great. But still, at the same time, we want to live today and tomorrow and next week. But to cost any more to live here just can't, that's all.
Well, Maury, this is about the end for us this morning here and talking on Meet the People. And we have another question that we must ask in order to fulfill our obligations each week that we've been asking it. Prior to the recent elections, we selected one question to ask each guest, and we prefaced it with this comment, that because of its controversial nature, the question could be answered anyway or not answered at all, because it requires an involved answer, maybe. It's been an issue that was voted on, but here it goes again, because it certainly seems not to be an entirely dead one. Do you have any comments at all regarding this thing called capital relocation at all?
Well, yes, I'll make a comment, Chuck, and then sneak out the back door. No, really. As far as the capital move is concerned, there were two sides to it, two organizations, one pulling one direction, one pulling the other. Both quoting some statistics as to the advantages, financial. Neither one very realistic. So that I think, as far as a capital move is concerned, that there should be, and I hate to go this route, but some kind of a commission has got to be set up where the actual figures as they exist can be taken to the people of Alaska and let them decide themselves on the basis of something that's not biased. You had a bias one way and a bias the other way, and the figures were in two or three instances very fantastic. It just weren't based on any reality at all. But some unbiased commission is going to have to come up with some figures and an answer that the people can consider. That's about it as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you. Maury Smith, our guest on Meet the People this morning, a most interesting guest indeed. An Alaskan, state representative, news commentator, analyst, writer, and someone we're indeed pleased to have with us this morning. Maury, thanks for being here. We'll see you, I'm sure, very soon again, and I hope that you'll be our guest sometime in the future on Meet the People.
Chuck, let me say thank you, too. I viewed this whole thing with some misgiving. I don't like to talk very much, but I've enjoyed this very much, and incidentally, Tiny's coffee here is very good, and the service is excellent. It's been very good. It's been very pleasant, and Chuck, I've enjoyed talking with you and answering your questions, and I think a good bit of the opinions are shared by yourself, too.
Yes.
And you can disclaim this afterwards if you'd like.
Very true.
As soon as you cut me off here, I'm going to get in my car and go up and see if I can't whack off a little firewood for the cabin and take it easy for the weekend. But this has been very enjoyable, Chuck, and I hope your program continues, and I hope a lot of Fairbanksians get a chance to talk with you on this program. It's very good.
Thank you, Maury Smith. We'll see you Monday morning bright and early. Until then, remember, it's not a case of growing old, it's just a case of getting tired faster. Like we say every morning, until Monday, chin's up.
The time is now 9:10 a.m. in the morning of November the 17th, 1962 at Fairbanks, Alaska. And this is Harry Hughes recording this tape for personal use only. I called Mr. Maury Smith, the commentator on this tape, and complimented him on his expression and his talk, and asked him if he would like to hear the tape back, and if he would like to set an appointment to any time, I would stop what I was doing and give him as much background as I can on the Pioneer Park and Pioneer Home projects that's transpired in the last 3 years.
It's past eight.
A capacity audience filling the courtroom last night in the federal building at 2nd and Cushman saw quite a verbal discussion on the proposed Fairbanks city budget last night. According to local citizenry speaking to the council, no one can afford to improve on personal property without expecting an increase in evaluation and higher taxes. One speaker told the city's lawmakers that painting a house and cultivating a lawn would increase the value of his home by $5,000 in the eyes of the city tax assessor. Not only did the local citizenry turn out in force, but the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce announced last night their displeasure with the proposed budget. Concurring with the chamber was the Fairbanks Business Association. One of the other two hot issues, the conflict of interest ordinance, was defeated last night. Once again, the chamber and the Fairbanks Business Association took stands against the year-old ordinance, with most of the speakers against it agreeing that if it were passed, many persons now holding both elected and appointed offices would have to resign, since the ordinance would restrict their work. Barry Jackson, city attorney, told the council and the audience during a public hearing on the ordinance that any person holding elective or appointed positions on any board or commission or any city employee were to hold stock or interest in any concern doing business with the city would be in violation of this ordinance. He said the ordinance has no escape clause whatsoever. In a move to get the ordinance on the table for voting, the council set the effective date and the penalties for violation before defeating it. Councilman Boucher was a leading backer of the ordinance, saying he'd been for the bill since introducing it some year ago. He said the council should take a positive stand by voting it in and then making the necessary amendments to it as the situation arises. The only other favorable vote was cast by Councilman Lefevre, who stated he thought the ordinance was virtually the same in content as several other ordinances the city already has. Other less lively council business discussed. The city attorney has been directed to draft ordinances covering the working of prisoners, one covering the maximum penalty in court for violation of city ordinances, and one for the disposition of taxed foreclosed property. I'll be back in just a moment with a report from the city fire department, but leading members of the Alaska...
I wish to thank John Griffin and KTVF China 11 for this opportunity to bring to you a series of talks so that possibly you can understand what we are doing with our budget. I would like to go into some of the facets of our city government, how it operates, the type of government we have, as to our budget, what must necessarily go into it, how we pay our debts, how we accrue these debts, the services that the people in the city receive from its government, what they cost, and the various facets of that. I do believe it's important that particularly on our budget at this time, that you know precisely where we stand. I think that probably, in the beginning, I should give you some information as to how our form of city government operates. We operate, of course, on a city manager type of government. Some people may not know precisely what the city manager form of government consists of. Now, it is written in our charter that we shall have a city manager form of government. This means that your council hires a city manager, and for all intents and purposes, the city manager is the administrator of the city, all of the various departments and the facets of those departments, and he is the head of the administration of the city. It also states in the charter and our various ordinances that the city manager shall hire all persons in the administration. The council does not hire the various department heads nor the people who work in those departments. That is the city manager's sole prerogative. The city manager also is the only one who can tell these various departments what they shall do. It so states in the charter that no councilman or the mayor may go to any one person in a department and tell them to do any one particular thing or to cease doing one particular thing. They must go through the city manager in order that these things can be done in the event they find something that needs changing. However, the city manager is the sole boss as far as the administration is concerned, and he alone hires and fires within the departments of the city. This includes the department heads. This is as it should be. You have to have a chain of command. It would be very difficult if we had six councilmen and a mayor running around firing or hiring people in various departments. I'm sure you can understand that. Also, we hire, that is, the council and the mayor hire the city clerk and the city attorney. These three people that we hire, your elected officials, the city clerk, the city attorney, and the city manager. They, in turn, run their various departments, and the city managers being the administration. Now, I don't know how many people did or did not know that, but that is one of the things that I thought it would be pertinent to bring out. One of the things that the city manager is required to do each year is to present the council with a budget. And in that budget, he must evaluate the amounts of money that we will receive in revenue. And through his office, he must also come up with a request for expenditures. This he derives from going to his various department heads to find out what they think they need to operate their particular department to give to the people of the city the services which they feel the people desire. Now, some of the interesting things about government that I find each and every person elected to an office does the job precisely the way they see it. Some are inquisitive by nature and will look into various things. Others themselves may or may not do so. I particularly take note that this year we are in a rather financial bind. It has come about that there has been a feeling with the people in the city, as indicated previously by some bond issues which we have attempted to put through as far as paving is concerned, and by persons coming to the council, various groups and so forth, that we feel the people themselves are at a high limit, that they feel they cannot go any further on expenses for the city, in which they would have to pay monies in the form of a mill levy against property. Now, we have a peculiar circumstance here. I may not have the absolute correct figures and could be corrected in the event I don't have. However, I'm only approximating. We have a situation existing here in our city where we have approximately 13,500 people. And of those 13,500, approximately 4,000 are property owners. And to these people who are property owners falls the problem of paying for bonded indebtedness under general obligation bonds. Now, I would like to go into some of this bonded indebtedness. You have possibly heard many times the council and the newspapers talk about debt service on a bond. Debt service is precisely the same thing that you would pay if you had an FHA loan and borrowed money or any other monies. Debt service is interest and principal paid on bonds. If we have a bond of, let's assume a figure of $4 million or $10 million, let's take $4 million, which we pass by a vote and which is put on the market and sold, and let's assume that it's at 20 years payment, interest and principal. It takes very nearly $8 million, or close to twice the amount of the original bond, to pay it back. I've got some figures here on bonded indebtedness. I hope you don't mind my reading them. These are so huge that I just can't memorize them. I find I do a poor job of memorizing anyhow. I like to look at my information and investigate it and bring it straight from the shoulder, which is what I'm going to do in these talks. Starting here, last year we had a grand total requirement of debt service requirements on general obligation bonds. Debt service meaning interest and principal that we would pay on existing bonds. Last year we paid $461,937 interest and principal on the bonds. Now, for the year 1963, in the budget, which the general manager, city manager, has given to us, there has to be included $621,222 for debt service or interest and principal on bonds. These are existing bonds. $621,222 debt service on the bonds. Now, this has to be included. You cannot preclude this from your budget. These are bonds that were passed by the public. They were taken to market and sold at the best price we could get, and this is the interest and principal on these. An interesting thing, as we go down the level, and I might just skip through some of these here, our bonded indebtedness, interest and principal that we would pay, is at this point is $621,000. In 1966, it will be reduced to $561,700. By 71, it will be down to $502,000. Slightly over half a million, and 76, it will be down to $422,000. The total amount of our interest and principal requirements on general obligation bonds from the date of 63 down to 1982, and that is each year we make these payments of interest and principal for the outstanding bonds down to 1982, the total amount will be $9,629,650. That's over $9.5 million that we will have paid out by 1982 in interest and principal on the existing bonds. I hope you'll excuse me. I've been having a battle with a cold for a couple of weeks, and it looks like tonight I lost. I hope I don't get too hoarse for you to understand me. Please bear with me on this. Some of the bonds that we have at present, which we are paying interest and principal on, run all the way from a date of issue of 1935. And they go on up, of course, from 35, 52, 53, 56, on up to 61. Mostly public improvement bonds, some sewer bonds, temporary sewer bonds, and various things of that nature. Now, we have two types of bonding. General obligation bond, which can be paid in two manners. You either put a debt service against the bond to be paid by a tax against the property, which is in the form of a mill levy, or, as in the case sometimes of our sewer or various things of that nature, we have an assessment. Nevertheless, each one of those types of bonds in general obligation go against your total ability to bond. Then we also have revenue bonds, and these revenue bonds are sold generally for utilities, and you have to prove in a revenue bond that you have a capacity of earning to pay off these bonds. They are not assessed against a property owner. A revenue bond pays itself. We have generally a earning capacity within our utilities of 2.4, and we maintain it at that, so that when a revenue bond does come up for issue, if it is acceptable to the bonding concerns and passed and approved by our bonding council, then it is naturally assumed by the people who purchase bonds that we do have the capacity under our present earning system to pay for a revenue bond. You cannot put street bonds and various things of that nature on revenue for the simple reason that you do not take in revenue on. And, of course, this is readily discernible. I find an interesting thing, however. Our attorney tells us that regardless of how you have put yourself in bond, whether by general obligation, revenue, or assessment, that you still have the authority and the power to take monies which we derive from various sources, and you can pay the debt service or, and again, the interest and principal. I want to keep saying interest and principal because debt service is sometimes misleading. So you can pay the interest and principal on your bonds from any source of revenue that you have. This includes, we get numerous sources of revenue from the state in returns from licenses, many other places that we get sources of revenue from, including the sales tax. Now, if we should happen to get a surplus of monies in the general fund or into the sales tax fund or any of these natures or places where we get money from, we can, in the event we do have a surplus, take that money to defray the interest and principal against a bond, so that it behooves the city to attempt to get a surplus in any of its funds or in any of its sales tax funds or general treasury, so that we could take that surplus and use it to defray the interest and principal on bonds. That's quite interesting, a little levity possibly. I asked the city attorney the other day if we had a law that might say that we could not get a surplus, and I see that we don't have a law anywhere. There's nothing in the law that says we can't develop a surplus. And that is, of course, a little facetious in that I do think we're going to attempt to get, and they are always attempting to get, a surplus so that we can do this. One of the things that is bothersome, in the past, a couple of years ago, the year prior to the time I came on the council, it was quite evident after I had come on the council and myself and another councilman looked into some financial things in the city, that the council had been presented with a budget purported to have had a surplus in it, and upon investigation the following year, we found this was not true. Because of that surplus, which the council supposed had existed at that time, there was a certain amount of money set aside to defray interest and principal on bonds. Consequently, there was not a charge to property owners in the form of a mill levy, and there was a reduction in the mill levy. However, we found out later that this was erroneous, and that instead of having a surplus, we had somewhere in the nature of a $500,000 deficit. This was due to the fact that there were monies indicated in the budget which were duplications of revenue and which were monies we would not get. And that because of that, we are feeling the impetus of it at this particular time. And let me assure you that on our budget here, this budget which was presented to us this year, we are going to cut this budget down to the bare minimum and the bone. We are just, and I say we, the council and your mayor, are just as interested and concerned at this time in not having a raise in the tax mill levy for those 4,000 property owners or for the other people in town for that matter, as you are. We realize that because of the previous budgets, that it behooves us at this time to curtail expenses down to a bare minimum. Now, when I say that, we have instructed the acting city manager at this time to pare this budget down to a bare minimum. At this time, with the outstanding bond that we have to come up with this year, which will be $621,222.50, we must have approximately 7 3/4 mills. Now, what we are going to have to attempt to do is to reduce this mill levy by developing some type of a surplus within the general fund or the sales tax fund by deletion of some service, and probably by deletion of hiring any additional help and other various things. Now, it's going to be a question this year of cutting down to a bare minimum the services which we give to the people, and yet which they richly deserve, but for good fiscal operation, we must necessarily get our financial house in shape. We are not in bad shape, actually. We are in excellent shape as far as our bonding ability is concerned. Now, make no mistake about this. This is something that I have, harped on many times. And I say harped on, I have advocated many, many times, and in particular in campaigns and various things of that nature, that it does not make any difference how much you can bond for or what your abilities to bond for are. It is the abilities of the people who pay these bonds that count. You may be able to bond for an additional $100 million, but if the people who pay the interest and principal on these bonds feel that they cannot pay them, then you cannot issue the bond. One thing that has brought about, I think, some of this feeling, in addition to our bonding, which must be paid for by a mill levy, we also have assessments, such as sewer assessments and street assessments, and when all of these are added together, it makes it quite difficult for many of our people to pay this much of an indebtedness. I think that probably the council itself, during this year and in succeeding years, will take a good close look at our bonding programs and some of our capital improvement programs. We would all like to have many nice things in our city, and I would too. But one thing at a time, we must necessarily make up that particular bad year when we did have a deficit budget. Incidentally, we had a deficit budget last year. Had we not caught it at the time we did, I think we would have been an additional $850,000 short on anticipated revenue, and this would have been really bad. Let me go back at this time to some of the things that your government does for you. The council itself, because it does not run the various departments of the city, must necessarily set out policy for the city manager to follow. Now, policy means many things to various people in governments. I think many councilmen, each individually, no two persons have the same idea on policy. But nevertheless, you generally get a consolidated working effort on policy. It has to be determined by somebody what type of a capital improvement we are going to have within your city. What you yourself want, and the various things that you feel you need, has an impact on what your city government feels it can do and should do. It may be that we need composite buildings. It may be that we need additional roads. It may be that we need libraries and various things of that nature. And your council has to make these decisions. This is what they are for. We have a planning commission that will set out an itinerary of what they think we need. and any of the beautification projects, or recreational projects, and various things of that nature have to be taken into consideration by your council. Then they take a look at our bonding, and at our budgets, and at the amounts of money. And you cannot project it for 1 year. You project it on again up until 1982 or for years to come, considering your growth factor and various things of that nature. So that your council itself has to make these decisions and has to set out to its manager, whom they have hired to operate the different departments, and who is the head of the administration, they have to let him know what things they feel have to be done in the matter of capital improvements and things of that nature, also services, which you are entitled to. And they have to set them out in a chronological order so that he will know which must come first, and at the same time, from the administration, we must keep a close fiscal approach as to what is being spent quarterly, possibly every 30 days. We need the report to find out if the monies that we have set aside are being properly spent, if there is sufficient money to carry through the project, or if we are going to develop a surplus, if we have possibly set aside too much money. It's difficult sometimes on these things to know precisely what you're going to come out with a bid project and things of that nature. Our firehouse over here runs a couple of hundred thousand more than we realized. And these sort of things enter into your government, so that I think it's important you know of these things. One thing that I want to again impress is that the city manager controls the departments of the city, and the council cannot tell him whom to hire or who to fire, nor can they tell a department head what to do or when to do it. They cannot pick up a phone and say, looky here, friend, you go up here and you do this. It so states in our charter that this cannot be done, and the city manager is both accountable and responsible for all of the departments of the city. And they may foul up in some manner, and that is his responsibility, and he is accountable for it. On the other side of the clock, if they do an excellent job, that is to his credit and theirs also. And I think that's very important, that the people know precisely how your chain of command operates. I cannot, as a mayor, your councilman cannot, as a council, tell any one of these departments what they will do or when they will do it, and we do not do that. We have to work through the city manager. If we have complaints, we have to go through to him and various things of that nature. It's very difficult to do sometimes, but I did want the affiliation and the affinities of city manager government to be brought to you so that you would know who operates the administration. And by administration, when I say that, that means the various departments are the administration. Your city council and mayor are your central government and elected officials. The other people are hired by the city manager, who is hired by the council. Now, I'm going to be on here perhaps for half an hour. We started a little late here tonight. I did want to get into this particular budget. I wanted to start out this program particularly to let you know of some of the things that go on in city government, what it takes to run your government, the amount of bond obligation that we have, what it would amount to in 1982, that we will have to have $621,000 plus this year in our budget to pay the interest and principal on existing bonds, and which will amount to approximately 7.75 mils. We're going to attempt to get this budget below this. We're going to have to delete some services, and I hope you'll bear with us. I'm not saying that we're going to just let the city go to pot. We're not going to kick out the police department or the fire department. We're going to look